Okay, so this morning, I'd like to study with you briefly about one of the most anti-Semitic pieces of modern literature ever written, and the message that this work has for us today on Tisha B'Av. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion is an anti-Semitic pamphlet that was published by Russia at the end of the 19th century. It purports to be the minutes of meetings that were held secretly by Jewish wise men plotting to control the world. The protocols consists of 24 meetings, during which time the chief of the Jewish wise men explains how to turn non-Jews into slaves and how to take hold of various global institutions. And I have here a few excerpts so you can get the flavor of what the protocols look like. On the first source, Protocol 1, behold, the alcoholized animals bemused with drink, the right to an immoderate use of which comes along with freedom. It is not for us and ours to walk that road. The peoples of the Goyim, you refer to the non-Jews a lot here, the Goyim, are bemused with alcoholic liquors. Their youth has grown stupid on classicism and from early immorality into which it has been inducted by our special agents. So they say that they are alcoholics, and we, our agents, are influencing them by tutors, lackeys, governesses into the house of the wealthy, by clerks and others, by our women in the places of dissipation frequented by the Goyim. In the number of these last, I count also the so-called society ladies, voluntary followers of the others in corruption and luxury. Our countersign is force and make believe. We're going to force and make believe, and make them believe in what we believe in. Only force conquers in political affairs, especially if it be concealed in the talents essential to statesmen. Violence must be the principle, and cunning and make believe the rule for governments which do not want to lay down their crowns at the feet of agents of some new power. This evil is the one and only means to achieve the end of good. We have to engage in evil, says the Jews, and we have to engage in force. We have to use bribery, deceit, and treachery to achieve this good. We must not stop at bribery, deceit, and treachery when they should serve towards the attainment of our end. In politics, one must know how to seize the property of others without hesitation, if by it we were secure submission and sovereignty. The first protocol, again, the Jews are slowly influencing the world through bribery, deceit, and treachery. The second protocol, in the hands of the states of today, there is a great force that creates the movement of thought of the people, and that is the press. The part played by the press is to keep pointing out requirements supposed to be indispensable, to give voice to the complaints of the people, to express and create discontent. It is in the press that the triumph of freedom of speech finds its incarnation. But the Goyim states have not known how to make use of this force, and it's fallen to our hands. Essentially, we've controlled the press. We're slowly taking control of the press. If you go to Protocol 6, we shall soon begin to establish huge monopolies, reservoirs of colossal riches, upon which even large fortunes of the Goyim will depend. You gentlemen here present, who are economists, just strike an estimate of the significance of this combination. In every possible way, we must develop the significance of our super-government by representing it as the protector and benefactor of all those who voluntarily submit to us. In other words, we have to say that we're going to take care of everyone. We're going to tell all the Goyim that they have to, that they should use us to protect them. The aristocracy of the Goyim as a political force is dead. The aristocracy is dead. We need not take into account, we have to worry about this aristocracy, but as landed proprietors, they can still be harmful to us from the fact that they are self-sufficing in the resources upon which they live. In other words, we want to take over, basically, we want to take over everyone by saying we're going to protect them as long as they submit their will to us. But we have to deal with these aristocrats who still have money and they don't economically depend upon us. So he writes, it is essential, therefore, for us at whatever cost to deprive them of their land. We have to take their lands. This object will be best attained by increasing the burdens upon land and property in loading lands with debt. These measures will check land holding and keep it in a state of humble unconditional submission. The aristocrats of the Goyim, being hereditarily incapable of contenting themselves with little, will rapidly burn up and fizzle out. So they got a plan to deal with the aristocrats. Protocol 11, this is just a sample of some of them. The Goyim are a flock of sheep, and we are their wolves. And you know what happens when the wolves get hold of the flock. There is another reason also why they will close their eyes. For we shall keep promising them to give back all their liberties we have taken away as soon as we quelled the enemies of peace and tamed all parties. So now we're going to tell them, you just follow us. We have to call for martial law. We have to suspend all liberties. And as soon as things are under control, then we'll give you back your liberties. We're going to make these false promises. Protocol number 12. Not a single announcement will reach the public without our control. Even now, this is already attained by us, inasmuch as all news items are received by a few agencies in whose offices they are focused from all parts of the world. There are only a few places through which all news is broadcast, and basically, we're going to control everything. We're going to have complete control of media, and he goes on to say we're going to have control of state secrets at the end of Protocol 12. Protocol 14, when we come into our kingdom, it will be undesirable for us that there should exist any other religion other than ours of the one God with whom our destiny is bound up by our position as the chosen people and through whom our same destiny is united with the destiny of the world. So we believe that we are the chosen nation. We must therefore sweep away all other forms of belief. If this gives birth to the atheists whom we see today, it will not, being only a transitional stage, interfere with our views, but will serve as a warning for those generations which will hearken to our preaching of the religion of Moshe, that by its stable and thoroughly elaborated system has brought all the peoples of the world into subjection to us. In other words, we're going to force. We believe that in our religion, and we're going to force our religion upon everyone else. In this difference in capacity for thought between the Goyim and ourselves may be clearly discerned the seal of our position on the chosen people and of our higher quality of humanness. We are a superior race. But you can see how this was taken by another person to subjugate us. In contradistinction to the brute mind of the Goyim, their eyes are open but see nothing before them and do not invent. From this it is plain that nature herself has destined us to guide and rule the world. And one more excerpt, one more protocol, 22. Again, there are 24 protocols. In all that has so far been reported by me to you, I have endeavored to depict with care the secret of what is coming, of what is past, and what is going on now, rushing into the flood of the great events coming already in the near future, the secret of our relations to the Goyim and of financial operations. On this subject, there remains still a little for me to add. In our hands is the greatest power of our day, gold. In 2 days, we can procure from our storehouse any quantity that we may please. Apparently, we have tremendous access to wealth. Surely, there is no need to seek further proof that our rule is predestined by God. Surely, we shall not fail with such wealth to prove that all that evil which for many centuries we have had to commit has served at the end of ends the cause of true well-being, the bringing of everything into order. What?
It's the Benjamins.
Yes, the Benjamins. This text contains a critique of liberalism, an analysis of methods that can be used to gain control of the world, and a description of a universal Jewish state to come. Different editions give different accounts of where the manuscript was found. In some editions, it was discovered in France. In some, it was obtained by a woman who knew one of the top leaders of the Freemasons, which is a society typically associated with Jewish conspiracies. And in others, it was presented by Theodor Herzl at the first Zionist Congress of 1897. What is the history of the protocols and who wrote it? At the end of the 19th century, when popular unrest was threatening the Tsarist regime in Russia, Pierre Ivanovich Rachkovsky, who was the head of the branch of the Russian Okhrana, the secret police of the Tsar, published anonymous pamphlets that he would use as proof of anti-Tsarist activity that needed to be curbed. And he was looking for a scapegoat in order to calm down Russian unrest against the Tsar in the 1890s. And the Jews, of course, come in very handy, since anti-Semitism was widespread in Russia, and conspiracy theories involving Jews were blossoming at the time. He fabricated the protocols in 1897 or 1898 in Paris, and he sent this manuscript to a Russian mystical writer, Sergei Nilus, who translated it from French into Russian and published the text in 1903 in a nationalist review called the Znamia, which means the flag. The editor of the journal was a well-known anti-Semitic leader in Russia and an organizer of a recent pogrom in Kishinev that took place in 1903. The Tsar and his advisors soon understood this document to be a forgery, but the Orthodox Church and other institutions distributed it throughout the Russian Empire. It was becoming, though, slowly lost in obscurity, and we weren't going to hear from it again until 1917. What happened in 1917? The Bolshevik Revolution. What? Henry Ford's after, so we'll get to Henry Ford in a bit. After the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, supporters of the ousted Tsar used this document to discredit the Bolsheviks, arguing that the revolution was part of a Jewish plot to enslave the world, and they used the protocols of the Elders of Zion as evidence. In 1919, the British white paper was produced by the War Cabinet about reports on Bolshevism in Russia. Let's read in source 2. Unless Bolshevism is nipped in the bud, and immediately it is bound to spread in one form or another all over Europe and the whole world. As it is organized and worked by Jews who have no nationality and whose object is to destroy for their own ends the existing order of things. It states that Bolshevism is organized and worked by Jews. There were a lot of Jews, obviously, in the Russian Revolution, but they're saying this is a Jewish plot. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion soon became a bestseller in Europe, and in May 1920, the Times of London and the Morning Post wrote that the protocols were real, as two British correspondents promoted the idea of a Jewish conspiracy in England. Look at source 3. The title is a disturbing pamphlet, A Call for Inquiry. This is from the Times of London on May 8th of 1920. What are those protocols? Are they authentic? If so, what malevolent assembly concocted these plans and gloated over the exposition? Are they a forgery? Have we been struggling these tragic years to extirpate the secret organization of German world dominion, only to find underneath it another more dangerous, because more secret? Have we escaped a Pax Germanica, only to fall into a Pax Judaica? And again, you can see this article in source 4. This is in the Illustrated Sunday Herald. This is a London paper which actually fascinatingly pits Jewish Zionism against Jewish Bolshevism as a fight for the Jewish soul. Because remember, at this time, this is just after the Balfour Declaration, only a few years after the Balfour Declaration. And look at how they analyze this in this article. Again, we're talking about in London, in England. Zionism offers the third sphere to the political conceptions of the Jewish race. In violent contrast to international communism, Zionism has already become a factor in the political convulsions of Russia as a powerful competing influence in Bolshevik circles with the international communist system. Nothing can be more significant than the fury with which Trotsky has attacked the Zionists generally, and Dr. Weizmann, by Weizmann in particular. Chaim Weizmann, the cruel penetration of his mind leaves him in no doubt that his schemes of a worldwide communistic state under Jewish domination are directly thwarted and hindered by this new ideal, which directs the energies and the hopes of Jews in every land towards a simpler, truer, and far more attainable goal. The struggle which is now beginning between the Zionist and Bolshevik Jews is little less than a struggle for the soul of the Jewish people. Okay. Now we get to Evan's comment. The protocols of the elders of Zion soon become a bestseller, not just in Europe, but in the United States. where it was published by American car magnate and notorious anti-Semite, Henry Ford. The Dearborn Independent, I have one cite from you in source 5. This Dearborn Independent was owned by Henry Ford. He published an American version of the protocols between May and September of 1920 in a series of articles entitled The International Jew, the World's Problem. And the articles were later republished in book form with half a million copies in circulation in the United States of America. And he writes here in this article, whosoever was the mind that conceived them possessed a knowledge of human nature, of history, and of statecraft, which is dazzling in its brilliant completeness and terrible in the objects to which it turns its power. It is too terribly real for fiction, too well sustained for speculation, too deep in its knowledge of the secret springs of life for forgery. If you also see, even Chaim Weizmann had to deal with this. Chaim Weizmann was one of the strong proponents of Zionism leading to the State of Israel. And he writes in his autobiography, Trial and Error, page 217 to 218, he writes how he had to deal with this. He was dealing a lot with diplomacy with the English government relating to a future Jewish state. A future Jewish state in Palestine. And he writes, this peculiar situation had not, however, developed for itself. In early conversation with General Deeds, I learned of at least one of the sources of our tribulation. Suddenly, without introduction, he handed me a few sheets of typewritten script and asked me to read them carefully. I read the first sheet and looked up in some perplexity, asking what could be the meaning of all this rubbish. General Deeds replied quietly and rather sternly, "You had better read all of it with care. It is going to cause you a great deal of trouble in the future." This was my first meeting with extracts from the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Completely baffled, I asked Deeds how the thing had reached him and what it meant. He answered slowly and sadly, "You will find it in the haversack of a great many British officers here, and they believe it. It was brought over by the British military mission, which has been serving in the Caucasus, and on the staff of the Grand Duke Nicholas. It would be a mistake to imagine that the views of the whole British army were tainted by the ideas expressed in the protocols of the Elders of Zion. But at a time when the horrors of the Bolshevik Revolution were fresh in everyone's mind, the most fantastic rumors and slanders operating frequently on existing backgrounds of prejudice gained credence, and the extracts from the protocols which I then saw had been obviously selected to cater to the taste of a certain type of British reader. Finally, in 1921, The Times of London withdrew its support for the pamphlet as the Times correspondent Philip Graves discovered, finally, that the protocols was indeed a fabrication. He revealed, and let's read a little bit in source 7, he writes here, the so-called protocols of the Elders of Zion were published in 1920 in London under the title of The Jewish Peril. The book is a translation of a book published in Russia in 1905 by Sergei Nihlis, a government official who professed to have received from a friend a copy of a summary of the minutes of a secret meeting held in Paris by a Jewish organization that was planning to overthrow civilization or to establish a Jewish world state. The protocols attracted little attention until after the Russian Revolution of 1917, when the appearance of the Bolsheviks, among whom were many Jews professing and practicing political doctrines that in some points resembled those advocated in the protocols, led many to believe that Nihlis's alleged discovery was genuine. The protocols were widely discussed and translated into several European languages. Their authenticity has been frequently attacked, and many arguments have been adduced for the theory that they are a forgery. And I'm just skipping to his conclusions here. Turning to the text of the protocols and comparing it with that of the Geneva Dialogues, one is struck by the absence of any effort on the part of the plagiarist to conceal his plagiarism. The paraphrasing has been very careless. Parts of the sentences, whole phrases at times, are identical. The development of the thought is the same. There has been no attempt worth mentioning to alter the order of the GD of a dialogue. A lot of this work was plagiarism of an earlier work. The plagiarism has introduced Darwin, Marx, and Nietzsche in one passage in order to be up to date. He has given a color to Machiavelli's schemes for dictatorship. We'll get to in a second what Machiavelli has to do with this. But he has utterly failed to conceal his indebtedness to the Geneva Dialogues. This gives the impression that the real writer of the Protocols, who does not seem to have had anything to do with nihilists, and may have been some quite unimportant pressy writer employed by the court or by the Okhrana, was obliged to paraphrase the original at short notice. A proof of Jewish conspiracy was required at once as a weapon for the conservatives against the liberal elements in Russia. The following conclusion are therefore forced upon any reader of the two books who has studied Nihilus's account of the origin of the Protocols and has some acquaintance with Russian history in the years preceding the revolution. The Protocols are largely a paraphrase of a book here provisionally called the Geneva Dialogues. They were designed to foster the belief among Russian conservatives, and especially in court circles, that the prime cause of discontent among the politically minded elements in Russia was not the repressive policy of the bureaucracy, but a worldwide Jewish conspiracy. They thus served as a weapon against Russian liberals who urged the Tsar to make certain concessions to the intelligentsia. The Protocols were paraphrased very hastily and carelessly. Such portions of the Protocols as were not derived from the Geneva Dialogues are probably supplied by the Okhrana, which organization very possibly obtained them from many Jews and employed to spy on their co-religionists. Essentially, Philip Graves revealed that the Protocols included sections plagiarized from a book written in 1864 by a Frenchman, Maurice Joly, who attacked Napoleon III and his policies. And the Protocols contain about 160 passages taken from his dialogue in hell between Machiavelli and Montesquieu. This is what's known as the Geneva Dialogues. By that time, by 1921, after this was revealed, most of the world realized that it was a hoax, finally. But that didn't stop other anti-Semites from using the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. The Nazis used it in the 1930s to blame the Jews for Germany's defeat during World War I, the financial bankruptcy of the state, and the decline of the German race. And if you look in Hitler's work, Mein Kampf, he writes in Source 8, to what extent the whole existence of this people is based on a continuous lie is shown incomparably by the Protocols of the wise men of Zion, so infinitely hated by the Jews. They are based on a forgery, and they say the Frankfurter Zeitung moans and screams once every week, the best proof that they are authentic. What many Jews may do unconsciously is here consciously exposed, and that is what matters. It is completely indifferent from what Jewish brain these disclosures originate. The important thing is that with positively terrifying certainty, they reveal the nature and activity of the Jewish people and expose their inner context as well as their ultimate final aims. The best criticism applied to them, however, is reality. Anyone who examines the historical development of the last 100 years from the standpoint of this book will at once understand the screaming of the Jewish press. For once this book has become the common property of a people, the Jewish menace may be considered as broken. So obviously Hitler, you know, views this as true. And by the way, even after the Holocaust, later in the century, last century, the Protocols become a bestseller in the Muslim world. And it was used to denounce Zionism and to explain away all the problems in Arab lands. This book has been used as a major source of Arab and Islamic propaganda. In fact, I read that there are at least 9 different Arabic translations of the Protocols. The harm that this work has caused to the Jews is very significant, as it is the proof text for much of the anti-Semitic claims of the past 100 years. And just think about Congressman Ilhan Omar's anti-Semitic tweets earlier this year. And you can understand the seriousness and the severity of this work even to this very day. This anti-Semitic work asserts that we Jews secretly are in the process of trying to dominate the world, and I think that this work has a unique message for us on Tisha B'Av. And in order to appreciate this message, I'd like to address the following question, and that is, why is the prohibition to study Torah on Tisha B'Av different than the prohibition to study Torah when we are in Avelus, when we are in mourning? Because if you compare sources 9 and 10, the Gemara says in source 9 that when it comes to Tisha B'Av, in the Gemara in Tanis, Daf Lamed Amud Aleph, the Gemara says, Kol mitzvos hanogos ba'avel nogos b'Tisha B'Av. All the mitzvah, all the commandments that apply to a mourner apply on Tisha B'Av, and you can't eat or drink. And then we'll skip a line. Va'aser likros b'Torah devidim k'suvim, you're not allowed to read Tanakh. V'lishnos v'mishnah v'talmud midrash v'hilchos v'agados, you can't do any type of study. Mishnah, Talmud, midrash, halacha or gadik. But v'kore b'kidos be'iyuv udvarim harom shebeyirmiya. But you may read Iov, you may read Kinos, you may study the Kinos, you may study the somber portions of Yirmiyahu, and v'tino kol shabes rabam b'telim mishum shenemar pikuda Hashem mishar mesam chelev. And also the schools are closed on the day because it states that the commandments of Hashem are just, they cause the heart to rejoice. So it seems on Tisha B'Av, you can't study anything except for somber topics. If you read in Source 10, the Gemara in Moed Katan, Daf Chaf Aleph Amud Aleph, there, what does the Gemara say? It lists all the things that Avo can't do. It says, Asur b'mlacha, rechitza, sicha, tashu, shamita, v'asur likros, b'torah, nevim, k'suvim, l'shanos, v'misha, b'mish, v'halachos, v'tamud, v'agados. So you can't study Torah. There is no exception for studying somber things when you're in Avel. So I want to ask first a very simple question. Why, when you're in Avelus, can you not study somber things? And why, well, is that true, first of all? It seems from the Gemara that you can't study somber things. And during Avelus, you can. Now, Tosfos actually points out in Source 11 that it's not so clear. Maybe you can study somber things when you're in Avelus. He cites first B'Tshuvos Rabbi Yitzchak Zekenai, in the Tshuvos of the Re. He writes, Ki Rabbi Yaakov Hoya Oser Bimei Evlo Be'iov Uvekidov Sudvarm Haram Sheba Yirmiya Midalo Tari Le Bishmaitim Kimo B'Tisha B'Av. So Rabbeinu Tam, the famous Tosafist, Rabbeinu Tam, in his early days, he read the Gemara. The Gemara says when you're in Avel, when you're a mourner, you can't study even somber things. Doesn't give that as an exception. So he didn't do that. However, but as he in his later years, he retracted. He thought you can study somber things, and he says that Avelus is just like Tisha B'Av when it comes to study Torah. And then he goes on, Rabbi Yitzchak Raya Lesor, but the Re thought that it's forbidden. Why? Because it says by an Avel Hanek Dom, and Umashma Kol. We're going to see the source for why you can't study Torah when you're in Avel is to remain silent. So that seems you can't study any Torah. It says, Ein nira li rai, I don't think it's a good proof. De lo kamer el bidavar mesamcho. Because I think that when it's said, with the source, it says be silent, it means be silent from only happy Torah. But you can study sad Torah. So the truth is, to be fair, there's a dispute between two giant Tosafists. Rabbeinu Tam in his later years felt that there's no difference between being an Avel, between being a mourner, and Tisha B'Av. In both instances, you can study sad things. Because in Avel, you can't be happy, so you can study sad things. However, the Re felt there is a difference. So I want to work with the assumption that maybe there is a difference. Why would you say that there is a difference between being a mourner and being and Tisha B'Av in terms of studying sad things? So you have to look at the source. If you look there's a different source why you can't study Torah on Tisha B'Av and why a mourner can't study Torah. So Rashi in Source 12, the Gemara says in Tanya says, "Va'aser likros b'Torah d'chsi mesam chelev." So when it comes to Tisha B'Av, it says you can't be happy. So I guess you could study sad Torah. When it comes to Avelus, so Rashi there in Moed Katan says, Vasilikros, why? Midama Rahman Yecheskel, Hanek Dom. God said to Yecheskel, be silent. The mourner has to be silent. So that may seem to indicate any talk of Torah, it seems, and the and but the during Tisha B'Av you just can't be happy. And the Meiri in source 14 fleshes this out, and he says that the amorim inatzrei Torah, because it says Bisan, this is my katan daf tesva mid aleph, and he says sheladas tzas aser af bikidos udvarim haraim. According to some rabbis, a mourner cannot study kinos and even bad things. Avo bishahutru b'tisha b'av sheba avel. Even though you're allowed to do it, even though a mourner is allowed to do it on Tisha B'Av, hadavar taloi b'shtika. An avel has to be silent. Uvetisha b'av edo talo ela bitzar. But a Tisha B'Av, it's not a matter of being silent when it comes to Torah study. You have to feel suffering. So if you study Torah that makes you feel suffering, then you can study. But a mourner can't study any Torah. Now, by the way, many of us in mourning, when we are mourning, so we study perhaps the laws of Avelos. That might be practical, knowing what to do. So that might be an exception to this, if you hold of that distinction. But right, the Mishnayos might be a zechus, right? The Mishnayos might be a zechus as well, right? So the question is, how do we sort of understand this? So let's say we understand this as on Tisha B'Av we can't be happy, but in Avel you have to be silent. So on Tisha B'Av you can't be happy. One of the questions actually that was asked is the following: are you allowed? Am I allowed to do what I'm doing now here? What are we doing now here? We're not just learning, but we're studying in depth. So maybe if you study in depth, it's actually a much happier form of studying. Sometimes if you just read, it's like, okay, it's not as interesting. But if sometimes when you learn a piece of Gemara, or you learn a parak of Navi, and you study an idea, and you got it, and you have a greater understanding, that can bring us to a certain amount of happiness. So the question is, on Tisha B'Av, when we say that you can study sad things, are you allowed to study it in depth? And in fact, if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, it seems that you're allowed to study. All the Shulchan Aruch says, he just quotes the Gemara in Source 15, he just says that you can study, you kore be'iov with dvarm haram shebi'yirma, you can study Eov and the bad things of Yirmiya. And I turned the page in Source 16, he says, umutra lomon midrash eicha, you can study the midrash of eicha, that's right, the Midrash of Eicha, and Perek Eilu Magalchim, and you can study the chapter that deals with mourning in Moed Katan, V'chei Lemot Perish Eicha, Perek, you can study the explanation of Eicha and Eov, so it seems you can study all these things in depth.
Maybe it's because in Yanei D'Yoma?
No, so my question is, can you study in Yanei D'Yoma in depth? The Taz in Source 17 says the following: Nearly, Dafilu B'makom D'Mutter Lilmod, Hainu sheyilmod bipshutan shel dvarim avlo derech pilpul. You can't study through detailed analysis. You can't study be'iyun. So if we follow this, you can leave now. Okay. You can only study the pshat. You can't study in depth, because that will bring you to a tremendous amount of happiness. And to such an extent, perhaps the Taz got this from the Shiboli Halekin, maybe. The Shiboli Halekin in Source 18 writes, this is in Seder Tanis, Simon Reish Samech Tes, he writes that there are some Gaonim who said that on Tisha B'Av we don't recite Birchos HaTorah. Why? Because, what's the bracha on Birchos HaTorah? La'asok b'divrei Torah. The bracha that we recite every morning is not something to learn Torah, but la'asok. What's la'asok? To be occupied, to work at it, to go in depth. And on Tisha B'Av, maybe we can study the bare bones, but we can't study in depth. So maybe there's a line of thinking that you can't study in-depth Torah. Question is, how can you respond to that? Is there legitimacy? What's the response to this argument? Again, what we're suggesting here is that when it comes to Tisha B'Av, the prohibition of studying Torah is based on simcha, based on happiness, and maybe just studying the somber things of Tisha B'Av, that doesn't bring you to so much happiness, but maybe studying in depth, it does. So how do you respond to that? So a few ways to respond, yeah?
So it's a split. In other words, studying Be'ion is more likely to give you simcha, right. But if you're studying Eon, right, all the sad things, it might
be more sad. Right, yeah.
I have a different approach to this whole thing, because a person who's in Avil doesn't have to do anything to create suffering.
Right.
Suffering. On Tisha B'Av, we have to do something to create suffering, to emote to what was before. So to my mind, to read Eov, to read the sad things, that brings a state of sadness. Once you get beyond that, you get to an analytic state.
Then maybe that's too much.
Not that it's too much, but you're in a sort of... Right. You're not trying to create the suffering. The learning of Torah in depth like that doesn't create the mood of suffering that is demanded of us on Tisha B'Av.
Okay.
You don't get emotional.
Right. Yeah. No.
Right.
The chadasha. Right. So let's see how this fleshes out. So I'm going to try to give a few approaches. Some of the sessions here. So the Ma'aril deals with this very technically. He wants to argue in source 19 in Simon Reish Aleph. He basically says his Rebbe Rabbeinu Peretz felt that maybe you shouldn't study in depth Eichon Eov. And he says, how can you study something without knowing it in depth? In other words, how can you like read something superficially? At the end of the day, either you're studying it or you're not studying it. If you're studying, you have to know what you're saying. So he's saying, you have to study it. And he actually says, he wants to argue that the more difficult it is to try to understand it, that's greater pain. In other words, do you focus on the end goal that you understand it, or do you focus on the method where you're suffering? So he's trying to deal with that. He's saying, even when you study more in depth, there still is suffering when you try to understand it. That's the way he looks at it. The Aruch HaShulchan takes a different approach. And the Aruch HaShulchan says that, he says, listen, this is in Aruch HaShulchan, Siman Tav Kuf Nun Dalet, Sif Gimel, Sif Dalet. And he wants to say, listen, when you study Torah, there's simcha. There's obviously going to be happiness. But when you're studying sad things, there's going to be tsar, there's going to be suffering. So there's both. There's happiness and there's suffering. So he wants to say, listen, there's obviously, whenever we engage in Torah study, there's a certain simcha, there's a certain happiness, because we have what he calls a nefesh. He says, Ikar esek haTorah mesamech es nefesh haYisraeli. Whenever we engage in Torah, it always gladdens the Jewish soul. It makes us happy. But if there is tsar as well, then it's okay if there's suffering as well. So he argues that when it comes to Devarim HaRa'im, somber topics, sad topics, you can study. Because, right, there's happiness and there's also tsar, but that's okay. The tsar is mevatel the avelos. The tsar, the distress, knocks out the simcha. The tsar knocks out the happiness. So therefore you can study that, and that's why he thinks that you know, he writes here that some of the commentators of Shulchan Aruch say in the Sif Dalet that you can only read it but you can't go in depth. And he says, that's difficult for me to understand. Because a Talmud Chacham who studies, he's got to know the question, the answer. He's got to understand it. But for me, it's fine. Because why? Anytime you read, whether you read Torah, whether you study in depth, there's always a sweet taste of Torah that you're getting. And the key is that there is tsar. So we sort of have two technical approaches to this answer. How can you study in depth? Because how can you study in depth? When you study in depth, there's simcha. You could say maybe there's not so much simcha when you're struggling with it. Or maybe as long as there's tsar, in what you're studying, and as long as there's suffering and distress, then that's mevato, that cancels out the simcha. But maybe there's another approach. Before we get to the other approach, which some people mentioned here, I want to flesh that out. Before we mention, I just want to point out there's a Marsha. And the Marsha points out, I won't get into detail about this, but the line when the Gemara says that you can't study Torah because it gladdens the heart, because it's a state of happiness, and he says by Tisha B'Av, it actually says that with respect to the Rebbe teaching the kids. And so the question is that line that you can't study Torah because it makes you happy, is that the whole object of notion of studying Torah, or is that limited to the Rebbe teaching the kids? It's not clear who's happy. The Rebbe, the kids, whatever the case is, and what the practical implications are, that's sort of beyond the scope of the shir, but that's an interesting question. But my point to you is the following, that the Maharsha believes in Source 21, that he wants to say that the reason why you don't study Torah on Tisha B'Av is not because of Simcha. He says that has to do with the Rebbe teaching the kids. He says, why do you do that? It's because Shul Yishkach Avelo Shel Yom. You can't study Torah because you got to think about what? The Avelus. And if you're so excited about the Torah, right, you're so excited about Torah, so you're going to forget about the Avelus. So therefore, you can study the sad things, but you can't study, you know, happy Torah. Now, if the Maharsha is correct, and we're saying that the reason why you can't study Torah on Tisha B'Av is because it's like happy Torah, because it's going to distract you from the day. So what's the difference between that and Avelos? So going back to what Heshi and what Yehuda were saying, so Rabbi Soloveitchik, before we get to Rabbi Soloveitchik, what's the difference between Avelos, what we call Yeshana, Avelos Chadasha, what's the difference between when someone loses a relative and what we're trying to do today? So the source that's given for what the Avel should do is Hanek Dom, be silent. So what happens when someone loses a relative? So when someone loses a relative, Rashi Moed Katan writes, Hamek Dom, he's silent. We know that an individual during Aninus, after they lose a loved one, before Avelus, before the body is buried, we know that the mourner is in a state of aninus. He is exempt from brachos, from positive mitzvos, because how can you praise God and perform mitzvos when you just suffered a tragedy? It's almost not human to do that. And that's reflected in the term, what is vayidom Aaron? Aaron was silent when his two kids were killed. Abraham Brunel says, Vayidom Aaron, hu shenapach libo v'hoya ke'evan domeim. That Aaron, what does it mean he was silent when his kids died? He was like a stone. He was speechless. He couldn't say a thing. So when we are in aninus, we don't perform positive mitzvos, because how can we contemplate the purpose of life after we've lost a loved one? So you might argue, once the body is buried, so now we perform mitzvos now. So now all of a sudden we shift gears. We don't fully shift gears. Yes, we do bench and we do daven and we do perform positive mitzvos. But still, how can we study Torah? Hanek dom, vayidom aron. Yes, we'll do the actions, we'll do the mitzvos, but we're silent. We can't. We can't. How can we study Torah? Even Torah of bad stories and bad events. In our actions, perhaps, we can perform mitzvos and we have to pray to God. But we can't speak the beautiful words of Torah were in Avelus, the great gift that God gave us during Shiva. It's inconsistent with our spiritual mood. However, on Tisha B'Av, Rav Soloveitchik says, in Source 23, this is Shuri Harav al Inyanei Tisha B'Av, Vanira Bazeh, the Devarim Haroim Hei Me'ikar Inyana de Yom de Tisha B'Av. Saying the bad things are not simply permitted on Tisha B'Av. Truth is, he's going a step further than the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch says it's permitted to study these bad things. Soloveitchik says they're not only permitted, they're part and parcel of what Tisha B'Av is all about. V'lo rak shemutu l'lamdom. They're not only permitted to study, el shezeh mahave kiyum b'avelos hayom. Because they are part of the essence of the fulfillment of the Avelos during the day. I might argue that maybe the Shulchan Aruch doesn't say it's obligated, because maybe for some people, they can read, you know, kinos all day, and they can just daven all day, and they'll feel the power of the Avelos. But certainly in our day and age, certainly studying in depth about the stories of Tisha B'Av and the tragedies of our people, so that is a fulfillment of the Avelus of Tisha B'Av.
Yeah,
that's the chiyuv, right, exactly. Even though they're defined as Devarim HaMesamchim, they're by definition the Divrei Torah, b'kovakov einam b'chlal ha'isr Talmud Torah b'Tisha B'Av. There's no prohibition to study this at Tisha B'Av. In other words, what some of the other, what the Aruch HaShulchan and the Maharil were trying to do is saying, you know, you can't have simcha on Tisha B'Av. Well, let's see, is there simcha? Is there no simcha by studying the somber things in depth? So Beijing sort of ignores all that. He's saying, even if by definition there is simcha, this is a kiyum in the Avelus of Tisha B'Av. Valpiza nira lahatra afa'in va'pilpul b'dvar maroim. And that's why Soloveitchik can spend the entire Tisha B'Av on the floor studying, going over the kinos for how many, 9-10 hours with his Talmidim in Boston. And because he feels this is a Gamze Mahavakium Bavelus Hayom, this is a fulfillment of the Avelus of the day, Kisha Osig Bidvar Maroi, when you're involved in the somber things. So, in a sense, for the Taz, just to summarize, there's no in-depth study on Tisha B'Av because it will lead to happiness. For the Maharil, the in-depth study does not necessarily lead to greater joy. For the Aruch HaShulchan, the sadness of the material outweighs the simcha that we feel when we're studying the material. But for Rav Soloveitchik, studying about Tisha B'Av in depth is an actual fulfillment of the Avelus of the morning of Tisha B'Av. That's why it's so different than regular Avelus. For regular Avelus, there is nothing to say. It's just a tragedy. But at Tisha B'Av, we learn about not only the tragedy, but the reasons for the tragedy and what we can do to undo the tragedy. But I would like to extend Rav Soloveitchik's point, but I would like to push it one step further. Maybe there's another reason why we are not only permitted to study somber matters on Tisha B'Av, but why we should study them and why we should study them in depth. See, there's a famous inconsistency in the Gemara as to why the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, as why the first temple was destroyed. On the one hand, the Gemara Nedarim in source 25 says, it's based on the Pasuk in Yirmiyahu, source 24, the Gemara in source 25, the Sechta Darim, Daf Pei, Aleph, Abed Aleph states, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, Maidich Simiha, Isha Chacham, Yavin Azos, who is a wise person who understands this, Dover Zed Nisha, Lachacham, Levim, Velo Pershuhu. They wanted to explain this phrase. They could have explained this. What was the phrase? The phrase was, Alma Avda Haaretz Nitzasa Kamidba Mibli Over. Why was the land lost? Why has it become parched like a desert with no passerby? And God says, Alazvam es Torasir Shunasak Lifneham. Veloshama Bakoli Velohokuba. And God responds, the reason why this happened to the land is because they abandoned my Torah that I gave them. And the Gemara says that the Chacham and the Vim could explain this. Ad Shepher Shekadosh Baruch Hu Ba'atzmo, until God himself explained this. Dirsi Vayomar Sheva Alazvam Torasi. Hainu lo shamu bakoli, hainu lo hokuba. So he said, isn't it the same thing? Why did it say, God, what does God say? They azvu Torah si, they left by Torah, and also lo shavu b'koli lo hochuba. Isn't this all the same thing? So Amar Rav Yehuda Marav, what was the problem? She'ein mevarchim atorah tchila. Why was the Beis HaMikdash destroyed? Because they didn't recite Birchas HaTorah. First of all, that seems very strange in and of itself, right? And second of all, it seems to be inconsistent with Meseches Yoma, Daf Testament Beis, Source 26. Mikdash Rishon, Mibnei Machareb, Mibnei Shlosha Devarim Shayubo, Avodazar, Gilarai Shvichos Damim. That, no, the first Beis was not destroyed because it didn't make a bracha, Birchas HaTorah. The first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of the three cardinal sins. And obviously, we have to try to reconcile the two. And the Medrash in Eicha Rabbah tries to reconcile these two sources. Was it Birchas HaTorah? Was it the three cardinal sins? So the Medrash in Eichas Rabbah explains, Rav Huna, Rav Yirmiya, B'Shem, Rav Shmuel, Rav Yitzchak, Amar Omar. Matzina Shevita, Kadosh Baruch Hu, Avodah Zarah. We find that God forgave them for idol worship. Val Gilo Arayas, He forgave them for adultery. Val Shvich HaDam, He forgave them for murder. V'lovita Amasa Shel Torah. But He did it, forgive them for the desecration of Torah. Shedabar, Alma of the Haaretz, why was the land lost? And he cites the Pasuk, Avodazar, Gilarai, Shvichos Dabib, Alzvaz Torasi, Ein Ksiv Kan. It doesn't say in Yirmiyah that they committed Avodazar, Gilarai, Shvichos Dabib. What does it say? Azvamas Torasi. So in other words, what's this Pasuk saying? The Pasuk is saying that it wasn't these three cardinal sins, they simply left by Torah. Rav Huda, Rav Yirmi, Shir, Rav Chia, Bar Abba, Mri, Ksiv, Osi, Azavu v'torasi lo shamaru. Halavai osi azavu. Halavai if they only would have left me. V'torasi shamaru. They would have kept the Torah. Mitoch shahayu misaskim ba. Hasor shaba hayu machzirim. What? Hamar shaba, right. Hayu machzirim lemutav. He said the following. Had, if you'd left me, but you had kept my Torah, then The rest of then basically you would have returned, you would have done tshuva, which is strange because that's not what the Gemara said. The Gemara didn't say that they left my Torah. What did it say? They didn't recite Birchas HaTorah.
That's what it means. Not acknowledging what the Torah, the ethics of the Torah, where it came from.
Right. So I think right. So the Ran. Right. So it seems. First of all, let's unpack it. It seems that God did not immediately punish them for these three transgressions. It seems that God had hoped, as it were, that Jewish people would, that the light of Torah would eventually inspire a tshuva movement. Once the Torah was abandoned and the possibility of the tshuva movement was unlikely, then God punished the Jewish people for the terrible transgressions they violated. So the Ran in Source 28 in Nedarim, Pe'af Amad Aleph, he cites Rabbeinu Yonah, who sheds light on this topic. And basically he argues that when you study Torah without a bracha, it means that you are studying it like an academic subject. Right? They weren't studying it lishma. Right? The last line he says, "Mitoch kach hayu mizalzalim b'birchasa, v'haynu lo holchu ba klomer b'chabad asav lishma." They weren't studying it with the right intentions. Now, by the truth is, we do believe mitoch shlo shma ba lishma. We generally believe that if you study Torah for ulterior motives, hopefully it will lead to proper motives. But I guess in a situation where the people are already committing these horrific transgressions, that's not sufficient. What? It didn't get them. Right. In other words, it did eventually lead them. Or perhaps maybe, yeah. So there are different possibilities of how you understand it. But at their state, this wasn't sufficient. And the Bach in Source 29 writes, right, it's not like that. Right, so what I'm saying is, right, I'm saying, mitoch shelo lishma balishma may work maybe for individuals, may work some of the time, but in their state it doesn't work. And what's fascinating is that the Bach in Source 29 says, what was the bracha they didn't recite? Asher bachar banu mikol ha'amim. The bracha that they didn't recite is that Asher Bachar Banu Mikol Ha'amim. They didn't appreciate the gift that they were given in the form of the Torah. That it's the key, that it's the guide to life. And if you study Torah feeling like it's a burden, without feeling the bracha of Asher Bachar Banu Mikol Ha'amim, either literally or figuratively, then it will not help us raise ourselves from our sins. Then we are hopeless and our temple must be destroyed. The ultimate problem was that we didn't feel that we had anything special. We didn't appreciate that the Torah was such a unique gift. And once we don't feel that, then we are more persuaded by the values of the surrounding culture, which in those days included the three cardinal sins. And make no mistake about it, this wasn't only a first temple problem, a Beis Hamikdash problem. This problem dates back to the sin of the spies that we also commemorate on this day. What did the spies say when they returned to Eretz Yisrael in Source 30? In Bamidbar Yud Gimel Lamed Gimel, V'shamar inu es hanefilim b'nei anak min hanefilim. We saw these giants, v'anehi b'neinu k'chagavim, and we were like grasshoppers in their eyes. And the Medrash in Bamidbar Rabbah, Source 31, in Parsha Tezayin Siman Yud Aleph says, Amru, they said, v'anehi b'neinu k'chagavim. They said that we were like grasshoppers in their eyes. Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, God says, Vitarti Aleihem. I would have forgiven you for saying simply that, Vanihi Be'er Chagavim. That we were grasshoppers, we felt like grasshoppers. V'ela V'chein Hayinu Be'eneihem. And so we were in their eyes. Yodim Hayisim Ma'asiti Etzchem Le'eneihem. You know how I made you appear in their eyes? Mi yomar shelo yisem beinam kamalachim. What? You don't think I could have made you appear to be like angels in their eyes? In other words, God is telling them that you had me protecting you. Maybe you appeared like angels. Why don't we think that we are like angels walking around with the greatest gift imaginable, namely the Torah? We have the gift of Torah. We have the gift Asher Bachar Banu Mikol Ha'amim. Nobody else has that gift. Why are we not proud of that? Why are we not proud to recite Asher b'charbanu b'kol ha'amim? Maybe we don't feel Asher b'charbanu b'kol ha'amim. Maybe we don't feel like the chosen nation. Maybe we don't feel so special about our unique privilege. And once we do not feel that special as Jews, then what we do eventually has no meaning, and we stop doing it, or our children see that we have no meaning when we do this, and they stop doing it. The key to staying spiritually strong is Birchas HaTorah. The key to staying spiritually strong is Torah study with rigor, with commitment, and with passion. Do we walk away from a Torah study session feeling exhilarated, feeling inspired, saying to ourselves, Asher b'char banu mikol ha'amim? And maybe that is why, to extend Rav Soloveitchik's point a little bit more, maybe that is why we should study somber topics on Tisha B'Av, but study them be'iyun with depth, because that is what we did not do in the time of the First Temple period. When we not only read the Kedos, but we try to understand them and learn about the inner meaning of the day and the tragedy of and the sins, we not only fulfill a key element of the day according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, but we begin to fix the problem for which the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Because at the end of the day, our fate and our destiny, whether we like it or not, is that we, the Jewish people, are going to be at the center of the world. We are the chosen people. We are the chosen nation. But what does it mean to be chosen? Rabbi Lam, and he wrote a letter in Jewish Action, Source 32. He writes, the doctrine of Am HaNivchar, the election or chosenness of Israel, has been glorified and condemned, but mostly misunderstood for the greater part of our history. Some have dismissed it with contempt and infamously compared to Nazi idea. This is Ehrenvolk, I think, means like the superhuman. Master race, right. Like the Aryan race. The comparison to the foul ideology of Aryan racial superiority is a vicious canard that has been with us since the Enlightenment, but ratcheted up since the appearance of mass anti-Semitism in the 20th century. The non-ideological discomfort that some modern Jews feel is more of a social nature. What will my non-Jewish neighbors think of me, us, when they hear of this boast? Underlies a good deal of the embarrassment with the Am HaNivchar idea. And not far removed from this concern is its enfeeblement and eventual excision by many liberal, modernist Jewish groups. We're not chosen at all. There's nothing unique about us. There are several questions that beg to be answered among them. Who chose whom at Sinai? Why was this chose made in the first place? What does this chosenness imply? So first of all, he discusses who chose whom at Sinai. The Talmud records two famous versions of the giving of the Torah. One has God, the Almighty, offering the Torah to various of the ancient peoples, all of whom objected to certain basic commandments, and only Israel, accepted the Torah in toto. The second has God coercing Israel to accept by threatening to bury them under the falling mountain. The difference between them is this. The first tells us that the Jews chose God. The second, that God chose the Jews. I believe that both versions must be read together. Both paradoxically are equally and simultaneously true. There was and is a mutual choosing. When we are born, we are inducted into the covenant of Avram and confirmed as members of the chosen people, whether we like it or not. We are the chosen, not the choosers. But as we learn and mature, we come into our role not by coercion, but by will and love and eagerness. Jews who reject the yoke of Torah are condemned to being the subject of divine duress. They are, no matter how much they try, Jews by birth only. They often suffer from their Jewish identity, anti-Semitism and confusion about the state of Israel, and spiritual rootlessness, and do not taste of the glory of Jewishness. Only when we turn around and choose Him and His Torah of our own free will do we experience the dignity and delight of being Jewish. Our choosing God is as important as His choosing us. When we are born, we are chosen to be Jews. We will be known to the world as Jews. We may try to flee from our Judaism, but they will find us. and we will become the center of attention. They will write about us. And in a time of galut, and in a time of exile, they will write that we want to control the world. They will write that we dominate the media and the politics of the world, and we are part of a secret society to destroy all opposition. But we can also choose God. We can proclaim out loud, Asher b'charbanu mikol ha'amim. We can recite the bracha on the Torah. We can be proud of our legacy and gift. We can use Tisha B'Av as a model for in-depth study of this tragic day to find meaning to make ourselves better. We can choose, and we are chosen. And it's going to be one or the other. The protocols, or Am Chacham V'Navon Hagoy Hagadol Hazeh. And it's up to us. When we truly have the attitude that Torah is a gift, that we are not apologetic for Torah values even today in 2019, that we run to bless the Torah, and we embrace opportunities in our lives to grow and connect to God, just like, as difficult as it is on Tisha B'Av, to try to grow and to connect to this day. But that's what we are doing here by sitting here today. We are growing and connecting, and we believe that there's value to investing time in Tisha B'Av. If we do that, then we believe that the Torah has what to say, the Torah is a gift, then the protocols of the elders of Zion will be replaced with other works. Other works where the other nations will not say that we are trying to secretly control the world, but they will say, Rak, Am Chacham V'Navon Hagoy Hagadol Hazeh. We are surely a wise nation. It will be a time of V'Hoya Hashem L'Melech Al Kol Ha'aretz, when God will be recognized as the King for the entire world. Today we observe the tragedy of the protocols of the elders of Zion and the impact that it has on us even today. But today we also know the remedy. Thank you.